show is all going to be about Houdini because we got Bill Kalush and Larry Sloman in the studio here, and we're talking about their new book, which is the new Houdini book, but it actually has another name, right?
Yeah.
What's the name of the book?
The Secret Life of Houdini.
The Secret Life of Houdini. And I am, you know, I have never, ever liked anything about Larry King. But right now, I just adore Larry King. Because Larry King says, you know, I don't read the book because I want to ask the questions the people at home will ask. So he's got that rationalization. And since I've been so, I've been busier than a one-armed bass player, and it is the book that I'm reading now, but I still have not finished it. I can ask you questions. I mean, this is really good. Because if I had read the book, I wouldn't be able to ask the kind of insightful questions I'm going to be able to ask here about Houdini. So why don't you pimp your book about the secret life of Houdini?
Well, good questions are a good place to start, but we can go without questions. We could just questions.
Well, no, we talked about it a lot.
Why did we write this book,
Bill? Yeah, why the hell did you write the book?
Why did we write this book? Well, you know, when you really look at the Houdini record, all the things that happened in his life that didn't make sense to us, at least didn't make sense to me in a lot of cases, why did he make decisions that he made? And we started looking at the people using modern techniques, modern computer searching techniques, things like that. We started to find interesting people that we didn't know a lot about and could find more about. And we started putting a new picture together. And I also felt, I was really inspired when I was a kid by a teacher who said, you should read a book about Houdini because he's really interesting. He didn't know I was interested in magic. He told the whole class that. Mm-hmm. And I actually read a book. I
think which
it was
book?
Milburn Christopher's
sure.
book. And you know, I wasn't sure about that. I had been confused whether it was William Lindsay Gresham's great book or whether mm-hmm. it was Christopher. And I actually went back online. My old junior high has their books, their libraries online, and I looked up which book they had, and they had Christopher, which makes sense.
And also gives you such credentials as a research geek. You know, we yeah, now but, we now trust you entirely on Houdini because you're willing to look up your
that.
Junior high Wait, library.
But how do you know you didn't steal the Gresham book from the library?
That's well, no, I bought one that had previously been stolen, but I didn't steal it myself.
Okay. All right.
But this changed how I saw the world when I read that book. Here's a guy who's a human being who is kind of a Superman. He can do all these amazing things, and he comes from nowhere, and he becomes this great guy. And it changed how I saw magic. And I never thought at the time, oh, I'll write a book someday. I just thought, this is really cool that people like this can actually exist, and they're real. And over time, as I got more interested in magic, the opportunity presented itself. I met Larry when he and I were working on David Blaine's book.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of fell out of this. We had lots of new information. We had a new take. And I really felt that there hadn't been a book, from my perspective, that told you, the reader, who Houdini was. What motivated him? Why did he do what he did? Not just in individual little circumstances, but his whole life, what drove him to, well, you haven't read it yet, but on his deathbed, admit that he's a fake.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's his, basically, it's not his exact dying words, but mm-hmm. basically his last important words were, I am a fake.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know how he got there.
But did he say that as a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's a big question. And I think he was relating to how powerful a doctor is who can actually put hands on somebody and help them from Houdini's perspective, who's dying in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was part of him that didn't understand just how big he actually was as well. Because he did this something a few years earlier. He made a real big push to get his name Houdini Eyes. The word Houdini Eyes entered into the dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
And what he didn't understand, we explain this in the book a little bit, is that his name had already entered the language, just as Houdini. I mean, nobody today uses the word Houdini Eyes.
Right.
But people use the word Houdini as a synonym. Oh, he did a Houdini. There's a big, long thing recently about a guy in South Africa, I think, that greased himself up and slipped right. through the bars, and all they refer to him as is the South African Houdini.
Right. And, I mean, in a Tom Waits song, he's going to pull the Houdini.
Right.
To leave town, to do anything, yeah.
Well, if you do a search of, like, modern, current newspapers,
mm-hmm.
the majority of hits, well, not now that our book's out, but before our book came out, when it wasn't, you know, we didn't bring him back to the, you know, the day-to-day topic, the term Houdini was usually in reference to something related to escapes or magic, more than the man himself. It was part of it was a language word.
Yeah,
you know, this pitcher did a Houdini by getting out of his jam in the eighth inning.
Right.
Now, when we look back, and we won't do this because we'll be dead, but 500 years from now, when people look back at the 20th century, I always have this question that I ask people, Houdini or Elvis? Because in entertainment, if there's one person who's remembered in the 20th century, is it going to be Elvis or going to be Houdini?
My opinion is that it will be Houdini, and I have a reason for that opinion.
And I wanted to hear that reason.
Okay. Well, Elvis, I mean, they'll be listening to Elvis, okay? Mm-hmm. I think 500 years from now, I truly believe that they'll still have recordings, they'll have film, they'll have all the stuff that we have. You know, I'm too young to have actually seen Elvis. I knew, you know, I was aware of him when he died, but I didn't, you know, wasn't part of that generation that, you know, idolized him. And but I've seen all kinds of Elvis on film and listened to his records and can get it. Houdini is more mythological in the sense that, yeah, there's some bad film of him. You know, some of those films aren't bad, but they're just hard to watch. They're silent, and it doesn't really capture who he was as a performer. But Houdini, as a synonym, as I say, you'll get this, Penn. Houdini's the second most famous magician who's ever lived. And everybody asks the question, who's the first?
Right.
And the first is so famous that he's become, his name is bigger than a human being. What do you call that? An eponym?
Yeah.
Hocus Pocus.
Hocus Pocus was a magician.
Hocus Pocus was a real live guy named William Vincent who performed as Hocus Pocus, and his name's all through the literature at the time, and it becomes so popular that people forget, they lose the fact that he's a person, and they just use his name as magic words.
Do you think Houdini will go that way?
I don't think we'll lose the fact that he's a person because we have pictures of him. We have the same reason we have Elvis recordings. We have actual material from Houdini that we can't have from the early 17th century. Mm-hmm. But I know that even when I was a kid, I didn't know until somebody told me. I think my mother told me. I thought Houdini was like anybody that was a magician was a Houdini. Uh-huh. I didn't realize there was a real guy named that.
Yeah.
And I've talked to other people. Somebody that interviewed us said Houdini was a real person. He didn't know. I mean, it was like an adult. And, you know, they're not always certain that it's not just a term for a magician.
Right.
So it might go somewhat in that direction, but it won't go as overboard as Hocus
Pocus. I think is fascinating about Houdini, and I think we disagree on this, and because you know more than I do about Houdini, I'm probably going to be disabused of something that's very important to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was most important about Houdini is a celebrity that halfway through his career, while very famous, pushes for an intellectual philosophical idea. I mean, when he started busting the spiritualists, we haven't had any. And you can talk about what Madonna did for women's views of sexuality. You can talk about what Dylan did for civil rights. You can talk about what Elvis did for bringing the races together. That's all early in the career. There's not another example I can think of someone that said, I'm really famous at this, and oh, by the way, there's no life after death.
But that's why we, in the book, we make that distinction between Superman and superhero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we talk about Houdini as a superhero, because, you know, he... This guy was probably one of the most famous people in the world at that time. He was could have rested on his laurels. He could have, retired, or, you know. But no, he did. He threw himself into this public advocacy. And, you know, he saw that the most vulnerable people in society, people who had just lost, you know, loved ones, were being completely conned by this group of fake spiritualist mediums. And Houdini, you know, began this crusade. He put a tremendous amount of his own money by today's standards into it, and made it a crusade. And you know, you're right. I mean, you know, Bono or Angelina Jolie. I mean, you know, that's the today's corollaries of that kind of thing.
But. Right, but it's not a philosophical idea. I don't think that. I mean, Bono is give money to poor people. But it's not as strong of a philosophical idea. Now, do you believe? Now, you think that Houdini was searching for a life after death that he thought was possible? Is that
I'm
right?
I'm certain of it.
Okay.
I'm certain.
You're going to have to convince me now, because I have always said, and Teller talked to me about the book and said that really troubled him. Because my view of Houdini is that when he said, "If there's a life after death, I will come back," it was a way of saying there is no life after death. Believe me. And you
that's absolutely not how he believed. And he says it over and over and over again. And we emphasize this in the book because I think that you've been misled, honestly. I think that the people haven't understood Houdini from that perspective. But a man who prays for his father his entire life, and at times in his life, believes that his father's influence from some other sphere has affected what's happened to him on this planet, is not somebody who doesn't believe it
can
happen.
And you're sure that's not poetic?
No, I'm certain that it's
absolutely
not. You'll read this in the book. Mm-hmm. Penn, when his brother Bill, his older brother Bill, was dying, I think it was tuberculosis,
right.
He made his, they weren't always best of friends, but they made their amends, everything was fine, and the last thing Houdini did was he got a telephone right next to Bill's place where he was going to die, and he said, now don't forget, he called him up just before he was going to die, and he said, don't forget our pact, that you're going to try to communicate if you can. And it wasn't cynical. Houdini, as soon as he got word that his brother died, he went home and held up. I mean, he went to his attic and stayed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was a day or 2 days, but he didn't
waiting
come out.
Waiting for a message.
Waiting for this message. He made pacts in real earnest, hoping that he could make communication.
But was it real earnest or was it a last-ditch attempt? By last-ditch attempt, I mean like my last-ditch attempt right here to believe that Houdini was not a believer.
He was completely a believer.
When my mom died, I felt all those things. And yet I'm an atheist who knows there's no life after death. And yet I always feel my mom with me poetically, you know?
Right.
And I certainly can understand that saying, if someone can come back, would you please, just as a way of saying, I am open-minded, which of course I always am, but not really very hopeful, just making sure.
You know, this distinction was broached in a series of letters between Houdini and W.S. Davis,
mm-hmm.
who is more in the lines of a spirit medium buster and a skeptic and mm-hmm. a guy who has that kind of philosophical position.
More cynical, I think,
yeah.
Davis.
Well,
yeah.
Davis.
Or more certain in his disbelief.
I'm very hung up on the word cynical.
Right.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well. Okay.
But
at least he's convicted that he believed that it wasn't real.
I think what Houdini thought is that you didn't need a medium to establish that contact.
So the mediums were all fake.
Were the fakes.
Yeah. Well, they were probably all fake. I don't think that he ever overtly said there's not a possibility. He just didn't believe that if there was contact possible, that a medium was necessary to make it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and part of the thing is that, you know, Houdini would write an article about this very thing and say in the article, like, you know, look, I'm not saying it's not possible. I made pacts with all these people. And then the headline writer would headline the article, Why I Am a Skeptic. So, uh-huh. So part of that could be just a misapprehension of, the people imposing their views on Houdini.
Well, people like me, because when I was a kid, Houdini was a real hero of mine, mm-hmm. And as I got older and as I learned more and read the Silverman book,
right.
Houdini became less of a hero. The more I learned about him, the more I realized that he wasn't really somebody that I looked up to that much. And what I've read so far in your book, which is a lot, is pushing that even more on me.
Really?
That Houdini, I mean, who would you compare? You know, people try to say, and I've heard this when people interview me, that Houdini was the most famous magician of the 20th century. And I always tell them, that isn't close to true. It is literally true, but the spirit is not true. He wasn't the most famous magician. He was the most famous entertainer of that time. I mean, you would compare him much more to Bob Dylan or to Madonna or to Elvis than you would the other magicians of his time.
Well,
I mean,
I agree with
much
that.
Bigger
but
than
you're just
him.
Giving him, you're elevating him.
Oh, much more than that.
You know,
oh,
he's
for
not
fame.
Just,
for
you're
fame.
Not saying he wasn't the most famous magician. You're saying he's not just the most famous magician.
Right. Saying that Elvis, it's like saying that Elvis is the most famous person from Tupelo, Mississippi. There is more to say that's interesting.
Right.
And it's amazing how Houdini, the picture that kills me of Houdini is him speaking to immigrants in the U.S. saying, I defy the jails of the world to hold me, and what that meant to Americans. And
right.
I love that modern kind of pro-science, physical fitness, all that modern stuff that he did and the way he used the press, I've always loved very much. But philosophically, I always felt early on, when I was 16 or 17, that Houdini was more like Randy, was more like the Amazing Randy in really having a philosophical point of view. And the more I read from what you guys did, I'm starting to believe you, that he probably was a believer. He certainly, you know, atheists will try to claim Houdini, and I always tell them there's one way the atheist can claim Houdini, and that is by lying. And I don't think it's really worth doing.
Right. Well, I agree with that. And that was a really... And Ratso and I went round and round. I mean, he can probably testify to this, that how we went head-to-head because I'm certain that he was not only not an atheist, but that he was a passionate searcher. We put him in the book.
We fought over it. You called him a spiritualist. That's why we fought.
Because in my worldview, in my worldview, somebody who believes that there's a possibility of communication. Now, I wasn't calling him a spiritualist with a capital S. I was calling him a spiritualist with a little s. Not part of the movement or the religion, but one of... those sorts, which I think are the majority of people, in America anyway, that believe that on some level that you can communicate with another, there is more than just what's here, and that you can communicate with it. So if you believe in God and you feel like you should pray to God, that is a form of communication to another world. Whether you can communicate with somebody who was on this planet who's dead, that's a slightly different thing. But I truly believe that Houdini was both of those. I think he believed in God. He says he does. He believes in him. He prays to God as an intervention with his own father and later his own mother.
He would say Kaddish wherever he was every year for his father.
Mm-hmm.
He was not overtly religious, but he was spiritual.
Right.
But
you can also do Kaddish as a cultural thing.
Right. Absolutely.
That's a possible thing to do. And that's where this gets so confusing, especially because he was a Jew. Because Christians tend to be very clear that if you're a Christian, you know, Jesus Christ is Lord and God and everything there. But with Jews, you have the culturalism that will allow people, and I have many of them that are my friends, who call themselves hardcore atheists and a Jew simultaneously.
Right.
There is nobody I know that calls themselves a Christian and at the same time an atheist.
Right.
You know, so there is that confusing thing, and that's what people who want to be self-deluded, like me, about Houdini, will hold on to. The possibility that he was a cultural Jew, which is totally groovy, but at the same time not a believer in anything supernatural.
But he, well, you'll what but we, no, what I, we well, you believe know,
I've been
is
saying
written
I was
down.
Wrong.
But you may
want to,
you know, you may call him a seeker rather than a believer.
But you can be an atheist and a seeker.
Right.
You can be very much.
Right.
I would consider myself to be completely open-minded to anything supernatural that comes to me. I just haven't seen it yet. And you can be a seeker and an atheist. Right. Those are not contradictory. And that's what I was kind of holding on to. But we've got Bill Kalush and Larry Sloman here, and they've written the book, The Secret Life of Houdini, and we haven't even gotten to him being a spy and being poisoned and the other goddamn cool nutty stuff you got. We'll be back right after that. This is Ben Jillette, CBS Free FM. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette on the Free FM, CBS Radio, PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. But we're not going to take anything that you send in, because there's plenty to talk about. Two guys who wrote the book, The Secret Life of Houdini, are here, Larry Sloman and Bill Kalush, and research nerds, geeks, magic freaks that have really looked into finding out more about Houdini than I ever knew. You know, they call me up for these... they'll do TV things where they're doing stuff on Houdini, and they call me up, you know, to be interviewed about him. And I always try to talk, you know, philosophically about what he meant to me, because I don't know Jack. So it's really good to have people here that really do know about him. And okay, I just want to make this very clear. As much as I want Houdini to be an atheist, as much as I want from my very heart for Houdini not to believe in a life after death, you have beaten me into submission, and I know that one of my heroes was a Jew. There, I've said it. you got that out of me.
Besides Jesus.
Besides Jesus, yeah. But, you know, when they asked me to compare, and I wanted to get back to this, how important Houdini was, I'm very offended when they say the most famous magician, because he's so much more than that. If you had to talk about someone who in the culture of 2006, right now, and I want to ask Larry this, because he's so pop culture oriented, Who would you say is the closest thing we have living right now to Houdini?
Bob Dylan.
That's always the answer I give.
I always say
when they say what was Houdini like, I say the only person who should ever be interviewed about Houdini is Bob Dylan.
That's correct.
He's the one you should talk to. And you wrote one of my favorite books on Dylan, Knocking on Dylan's Door.
On the Road with Bob Dylan.
On the Road with Bob Dylan. Yeah. But wasn't the article?
One of my articles was called Knocking on Dylan's Door.
But on the Road with Bob Dylan, which was about Rolling Thunder.
Yeah, and so it was also a good way to sum up that whole book, me knocking on Dylan's door, trying to get an interview. No, we toured in 1975 with the Rolling Thunder Review. I was covering it for Rolling Stone magazine. I had a fight with the editors in the middle of the tour. I left my rented car somewhere in Canada and then just hooked up with the tour. Dylan hired me to kind of be an advance man for the movie that they were doing, Ronaldo and Clara. So I would go into Boston and round up, go to the combat zone, round up hookers to get in the movie and things like that.
Can you talk? I mean, I don't want to force you to talk about my ideas. But is there anything you want to say about Dylan and Houdini?
Well, I mean, basically was off the top of my head because I think. Dylan's work will last so long, and I think, you know, Houdini, I mean, I think they both, in a sense, appealed to the notion that they couldn't be bound. Now, Houdini physically couldn't be bound, and I think Dylan, if you follow his career and his permutations over the years, he couldn't be put in intellectual binding of any sort. So, I mean, in that respect, I think that's...
And also, you know, the idea of Dylan, and Dylan being able to mean so many different things to so many people. I meet other Dylan freaks, right. And I am a Dylan freak, and we have nothing in common. And I love that if you're a fan of other bands, you have in common with the other fans. You have something in common with them. I disagree with Dylan freaks about everything about Dylan except that we love him.
Right.
And with Houdini, when you're sitting around with a bunch of magicians who and Houdini is so important to me. And yet, I will sit around with people. It's the same kind of thing. What I take from what Houdini was is entirely different from what other people take because the iconography, the ideas that they created were so universal and so powerful and so important that people that disagree entirely about politics, disagree entirely about philosophy, can really agree that Dylan or Houdini spoke to them very much. Mm-hmm. And in your research, you also, one of the things that's talked about the most, and the thing that's blowing my mind, is the idea of Houdini being a spy. And you should just talk about that. Give me your stock short answer on that.
Well, I guess it starts with the letter that Bill found.
Well, in the last big biography, and it's a great book by Ken Silverman, mm-hmm. he alludes to this, somebody spreading a rumor that Houdini was a spy. And we tracked down the letter that he was talking about. He footnoted where the letter was, and it came up for auction, and we bought the letter. And it was from a magician friend of his from Glasgow who was writing to Houdini to tell him that somebody was running around Glasgow, another escape artist, saying that he was a spy for Germany. And the letter itself is kind of unimportant because it's not true. He wasn't a spy for Germany, and this is a guy just trying to slander Houdini. But the idea that, well... would somebody like Houdini be used as a spy? So then we started doing research into how did spying work back then. Now, part of the problem with people resisting, and I mean by people, magicians, okay?
So not really people.
Not but actual...
subspecies.
A subspecies of people, magicians. And obviously I'm joking, I love magicians. Stop writing bad things on Amazon about me. the idea that that Houdini could be a spy is predicated in the fact that what a spy was in 1900 is completely different than what a spy is today. I mean, we have these enormous agencies with thousands upon thousands of employees and billions of dollars in budgets, and every country has one of those. And back then, the whole United States had no spying agency whatsoever until 1898, at least any foreign spying capabilities other than the State Department. Until 1898, when John Wilkie was kind of plucked out of his newspaper job in Chicago and made the chief of the Secret Service. And just at that point, the U.S. got involved in the Spanish-American War, and the Spanish were sending spies into Montreal to spy on U.S. things. I don't know exactly, I can't recall exactly what they were trying to find, but Wilkie sent up and used actually a magician as cover, a boxer who is also a magician.
Who was the heavyweight champion of the world at the time?
And a magician?
And he started, yes. And he actually performed magic. Was a friend of Houdini's. It's another story. Wilkie was the first guy. Chief John Wilkie was the first guy to actually start with foreign espionage by an agency in the United States. And it's interesting because Wilkie, we found out, was a magician who, in the Sphinx magazine, they say he's one of the most talented amateur magicians in the country. And we started digging through old newspaper clippings looking for Wilkie now, something no Houdini guy's ever done before. There's never been a connection. And we find out that Wilkie's not only a talented magician, he's using magicians as agents. So then we figure out exactly...
Now, what do you mean? That's a really big sentence, he's using magicians as agents. He's just started the agency. How do you know... He's using magicians as agents.
Well, actually, he didn't start the agency. That's even more interesting. The agency was started by Lincoln, okay? And he did have spies. One of the first spies Lincoln ever used was a guy named Horatio Cook, who was an escape artist, and he battled fraudulent spear traps.
Right.
And Lincoln...
Prototype of Houdini.
And Lincoln, and later was a good friend of Houdini's.
Right.
He lived to be really old. And Lincoln, he was at Lincoln's, he was in the theater when Lincoln was shot, and he was at Lincoln's bedside when Lincoln died. And Lincoln actually gave him part of the job as a scout, kind of the beginning of the Secret Service, because...
If you're in the Secret Service and you're with Lincoln when he's shot, you're not that good a Secret Service guy.
Well,
don't
say that, because one, he wasn't working for the Secret Service at the time.
Okay, okay.
The Secret Service job during the Civil War was merely... as scouts. That's what I'm saying worked for the Secret Service. They were doing scouting.
And
after the war...
And he used his abilities.
That's right. Well, he impressed Lincoln with his abilities. That's how he got the job, to escape. But he wasn't there to protect President Lincoln at the theater. Secret Service didn't have that charge until after the turn of the century.
Well, that's always been... It's the Treasury Department.
Well, they're part of the Treasury Department, and their real job, other than originally being scouts for the North... They handled counterfeiting. That's what they did. And so we started looking at all these. I'm not going to go into all this detail because obviously it's 600 pages worth of detail on this stuff. But who the people were and where Houdini's big break really came. And the fact that it was Chicago. And Wilkie was a magician who was the chief of the Secret Service, who's a member of a private club. He's from Chicago. He's a newspaper man in Chicago. He's written about a guy named Andy Rohan, who's also a police officer in Chicago. This particular police officer... is the guy, when Houdini is ready to fail, he goes in front of this officer, and the officer endorses him. The next day, Houdini's picture's in the newspaper, and he goes from, I'm going to quit and become a locksmith for one of Bess's cousins, to, this is really going to work. And all of a sudden, Martin Beck notices him, and he's off and running. And all these people have this amazing nexus of, they're all members of the same club. They all benefit.
What club is this?
IACP.
The International Association of Chiefs of Police. And they're still around. They're a private club. They were organized specifically because in the U.S. we have a federal system. We don't have a national police force. We're not supposed to have one. I mean, we kind of do now, but we didn't then, and we weren't supposed to. And if you were an officer in Chicago and you had to chase somebody who was now in Oklahoma City, you didn't have any mechanism.
Right.
So they formed a club. They said, hey, we'll all join a club. And if you got a guy I'm looking for in Omaha, you have to send them.
Yeah.
Okay. And it still exists, and they're secretive, and it's a very interesting organization.
Now, what do you think, and just as a way to sum it up, and I know you don't know this, but what do you think was the conversation, the deal that was made with Houdini?
I think if there was an overt deal, it was, we'll help you with our friends. you know, you'll help us if you can help us. We'll help you if you can, if you can help us, you'll tell us what we need to know. This is what happened in the U.S. This is what appears to have happened. And we don't, in the book, overtly say that they had a deal. We don't know for certain. We know these sorts of things did happen. We know that there's a great coincidence with his success happening with Rohan. We know that Wilkie being a magician is, and admitting that magicians acted for the, you know, he talks in one of the newspaper articles we found about sleight of hand guys, magicians that he worked for the agency that were far better than him, that went out and did things like, one thing he talked about was doing some sleight of hand maneuver he doesn't describe with the counterfeiting issue. Like, you, they're pretending to spend counterfeit money, but that would be illegal, so they're actually switching out the counterfeit for real coins as they're going along, and they're using magicians to do this. So, but the next thing that's interesting is he goes from eating dry potatoes, cold potatoes, and living under benches some nights, and considering leaving the business and starting a magic school, or becoming a locksmith, or both, to making what today is the equivalent of 40 grand a week in our money.
I love the way you do that in the book. But the amount of money is today's right. money. No one ever does that. It's the most important thing to do when you're thinking about things that happened in the past. We want to know what Fatty Arbuckle made in today's terms.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how do you tell? And it's
so that's a great part of the book.
And it just made no sense. And that was one of the things early on in our research. You know, I'm looking at this chronology, and he's making an equivalent of $40,000 a year.
$40,000 a week.
I mean, a year.
It makes a big difference.
I mean, $40,000 a week, a year after he was ready to quit magic. All of a sudden, he leaves all his bookings in the United States and goes without any bookings to England.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they said, well, you know, the conventional wisdom was, well, he wasn't making it here, so he went. He figured if he goes to England, he could make it there and then come back.
Always that's
he leaves contracts that he's agreed and signed with Martin Beck to make that kind of dough. Okay. Here's a guy who'd been starving a few months earlier. He's got the money in hand.
Right. They also said he didn't make it big in the East Coast, which was absolutely,
not true.
He was huge in Boston. They were saying he was better than Herman and any other
and
magician.
Keller.
And we're gonna take a break right now and come back and talk to Bill Kalush and Larry Shloman, who have written the book The Secret Life of Houdini. They've talked about him being a believer. They've talked about him being a spy. Now they're going to talk about him being murdered. These two goddamn nuts are on the show. We'll talk to them some more. It's a great book. I'm in the middle of reading it, and I'm going to finish it. The Secret Life of Houdini. This is Ben Gillette. We'll be back right after this on CBS Radio, Free FM. Free FM, CBS Radio, penradio at gmail.com, penradio.com. I have two great authors, Larry Shloman, who's written a lot of cool stuff, Bill Kalush, and they've written this book called The Secret Life of Houdini, and Research Nuts. You know, the thing that's great about you guys is that you're backing everything up, you know, because they've written a lot. There have been a lot of really bad books about Houdini, and we don't need to detail them, but all these like pseudo psychological that just are so offensive and so crazy, and someone digs into their own personal garbage.
Yeah, he was impotent, and that's why he visited graves.
Yeah,
because he liked to stand over a grave.
Yeah, they have stuff like that. But you guys,
we don't say that in our
no,
no. But The Secret Life of Houdini, you were talking about how he gets in touch with a few police officers and people who are starting Secret Service, and his career starts going really good. And while it's going really good, which is totally contrary to everything I've ever believed about Houdini, I thought he was the same as Hendrix. You know, Hendrix didn't make it here, right. Went over to England, hit it big, came back with the English
right.
credibility, and I always, that was the comparison I always made. And not true. He's a huge star here, doing 40 grand a week in our terms, in our money. Mm-hmm. And then he goes over to England with no bookings, and what happens then?
Well, he gets off the ship. He doesn't have a deal. He doesn't have a contract. And he gets off the ship, and within a couple of days, he meets the most important police officer in England. And, I mean, this is a big deal. This has never been really pointed out. And maybe the technology to find these answers wasn't around before. But he, within a couple of days off the ship, he's in front of a guy named William Melville. Melville. Now, Houdini uses the name Melville. He tells us in his notes and even on his brochure just thereafter, William Melville endorses him. But some people never even thought that he'd actually been in front of Melville. But what Melville was he was the chief of Special Branch at Scotland Yard. He was, and Special Branch was the part of Scotland Yard that did foreign intelligence. That's what they did. That was his job. And he was a household name. He was a guy, Melville's biographer says that he was so well known that people on everybody on the street knew who he was. He was a famous guy in his own right. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of days, Houdini's in front of him. And it's always been kind of told as, well, you know, the guy at the Alhambra, Dundas Slater, mm-hmm. took him over to Scotland Yard and said, hey, you know, if you can get out of their handcuffs, then we'll give you a job. And when we talked to Andrew Cook, the great, he's one of the top intelligence experts in the world in British intelligence, we said, well, would Melville actually make time to audition possible music hall guys? And he said, absolutely ridiculous. It's not possible. And what we found out through Andrew Cook was that there was, well, first off, this Melville turned out to really be somebody special. He retired from Scotland Yard and went off to tend his flowers. That was the official story until the 90s when it finally came out that MI5 really does exist and that he was the guy with another guy, Vernon Kell, who started it. And he was the first real spy master in British history.
Probably the prototype M.
Probably the prototype M.
Ian Fleming.
Yeah. And he's actually the guy who wrangled Sidney Reilly, who a lot of people think is the prototype for James Bond. And so we find out, and I don't believe Mr. Cook realized this, but he knew that there had been a connection between Houdini and Melville. But in Melville's diary, his professional diary, which Cook had found through the family that had migrated to New Zealand,
I think it was 3 years.
It was just one part. No, it was more like 8 years worth, yeah. But it was not the diaries. It wasn't his whole career. But Houdini was sending back information. And,
we asked Cook to look through the diary. He found references to HH. Now, you know, their codes weren't very sophisticated in those days. So we say, well, let's look at all the references to HH. First reference, bingo. Went to see HH at the Alhambra for his press preview. And then,
and it was the date that it was Houdini's right, press preview. I mean, it was unequivocal that it was, you know.
But so you're saying, I just make this clear, is he a spy for the U.S. or a spy for England?
He was helping the agencies, we believe, in the U.S. while he's in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Whether there was contact with the U.S. in while he's in Europe, there was a lot of interest in anarchists. I mean, anarchists then were a very interesting parallel to what's going on with international terrorism today. Mm-hmm. They were blowing things up. There was a lot of that sort of thing going on. Andrew Rohan, the man who was on the scene when Houdini became famous in Chicago, had been chasing anarchists himself in Chicago. In fact, he became famous catching an anarchist in Chicago.
And Wilkie was consumed by it because McKinley was killed by an anarchist under his watch. Mm-hmm. So then he just, you know.
Now, do we have papers that say he was sending back information to the Secret Service in the U.S.? No, we do not. But we do know that Melville's also interested in anarchists, and he has a close relationship with the Okhrana, the Russian Secret Service at the time under the Tsar. And we found out that these HHs in Melville's diary. Now, Mr. Cook didn't know what they meant. He knew he had figured out who HH was. He mm-hmm. put that together. But he didn't know where HH was when he's getting Melville's writing things like received report from HH, took it straight to the War Department. He didn't know, you know, but when we looked at it, we immediately put it against our timeline and said, well, he's always in Germany. You know, he's in Germany at this time. And it's really stunning, some of the things. I mean, you knew that he was a flyer because you've read other bios of Houdini.
That's what he's famous for. First man to a sustained flight over Australia.
Right.
That's why we know the name Houdini. Well, that's what Houdini thought, right?
I mean, to some extent he thought that. He did underestimate his own level of fame.
Well, you'd have to. You could not conceive of that level of fame.
No.
I mean, no one could.
No one else had it either.
I want to get to this because it's so nutty. I don't want you to overstate your position, but you think there's a possibility that Houdini was poisoned to death.
Okay.
Talk about that.
Yes. Here's where it came from. First things that we noticed that's never been in a Houdini biography is that what had been considered the real cause of his death, that a kid had punched him, a college student had punched him in the abdomen while he was in Montreal.
Not that he died in the water torture cell.
No, he didn't die in the water torture cell. And that's such... Let's talk about that for 5 seconds.
Sure.
It's such a passive-aggressive thing for Hollywood to do. To take this Superman who hadn't failed in any of his stunts and kill him off in one on stage. Yeah. I mean, it's so horrible.
Not as bad as Pendemption's, the evil pen. Pendemption's show, TV show, what was that, 10 years ago, where Houdini comes back from the dead and talks to Bess in the final thing. I mean, Hollywood is really beside, you know, putting a Bible in Mark Twain's house and talking about how Jefferson wanted a king. But, you know.
Exactly.
But so
what we realized was that, a punch, when we started talking to doctors, and nobody, I'm just shocked that nobody else has ever brought this up, but punches can't cause appendicitis. You can't use trauma. Traumatic. Doesn't cause the appendix.
Unless you're a Jewish believer.
Well, the appendix, it gets inflamed because of some sort of bacterial issue or some sort of blockage,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't happen from trauma. Otherwise, baseball players or boxers or people that are involved in terrible automobile accidents would also get appendicitis, mm-hmm. and they don't. So the first thing is,
I'm so mad at you for realizing that, because I have always just told people he got punched in the stomach and ruptured his appendix, and all this information that you're talking about was there. I had it. Why are you the first guy smart enough to do this? So that's a whole other issue. Someone will write a book about why were these two guys smart enough.
Why are these guys so smart? And then we found a letter that hadn't been made public. From Bess, his wife, to Arthur Conan Doyle. And that's a whole other thing that you're going to love when you get to the end of this book, because who Arthur Conan Doyle was in this is completely different than what's been always told. He's not this duffer believer that thinks he's running the whole world and that we're in the end of days and he's going to inherit the world. Okay, he believes that.
Well, he's been told that.
Tall Gentile.
Yes. Now,
Houdini, short Jew. So who am I identifying with? Go ahead.
Well, if your wife comes to you and says that Phineas has a message,
right.
then we'll know who you'll be. So she, as soon as Houdini's dead, now they've been out in the outs, Doyle and Houdini,
mm-hmm.
and when he died, Doyle starts writing to his wife, because he has an agenda. He wants to convert the dead. He wants to posthumously make Houdini into the spokesman for spiritualism that he couldn't make him into while
Which
he was
Which is what
breathing.
You're trying to do.
No. We're just telling the actual
okay.
story. So what happens is Bess writes back and says, well, I wasn't so worried about him because the doctors, she had been checked into the hospital for poisoning. Now, they thought it was some sort of non-determinate food poisoning, okay? They didn't know what it was. But something she'd ingested made her so sick that she also was checked into the hospital, and the doctors told her that she was more at risk than her husband was.
Plus, Houdini also had suffered from
so-called
ptomaine poisoning right before he left for the tour.
But ptomaine poisoning at that time was poisoning, right?
Well, yes.
I mean, there wasn't bacterial studies.
No, we don't know what it was.
We don't know.
But we know that he was sick from something he put in his mouth. Something he'd eaten made him sick enough to be, you know, and his wife is apparently nearly on her deathbed, unless she was just being overly dramatic. But what that made us think was, hold it, he was sick before. Now they're both with it. Now, this isn't something, you don't get appendicitis and give it to your wife.
I mean,
they're both sick with something they'd ingested. And also the whole world, I mean, this was, we realized this before Yushchenko, or certainly before this last thing with the Russian spy in London. But poisons are really wicked things that are really difficult to detect, and that Houdini'd never been autopsied. And then we started looking into this amazing connection with Dr. Crandon, Marjorie's wicked, wicked husband.
And
this
right
is,
when you say Marjorie, as if magic, the music comes up in the background. Bill Kalush, Larry Sloman. The book is The Secret Life of Houdini. A spy, poisoned, a believer, all those things, and they back them up. And it makes me crazy because it's the book that I should have written. And except I wasn't willing to work hard enough. That's all that stopped me. It's not a lack of talent. It's a lack of being willing to work. This is Penn Jillette, CBS Radio, Free FM, Secret Life of Houdini. Read it. It's a great book.